Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's clear and cold tonight in the Western Desert. The solar wind tonight is blazing at 618.9 kilometers per second, but there are still no sunspots. There is a coronal hole facing Earth right now. This resulted in amazing aurora activity last night in Ersfjord, Norway. Bjorn Jorgensen observed an outburst of auroras so powerful it turned the ground green. The display lasted only a few minutes, but that was enough for an unforgettable snapshot. If you want to see this photo, just go to spaceweather.com and have a look. The aurora has surprised solar scientists lately, as the Themis probes, a set of five satellites launched a year ago, study the phenomenon. Apparently, the aurora appears when there is no solar wind and doesn't appear when there is a solar wind. The lights are the result of cosmic radiation striking the upper atmosphere, then cascading into cosmic rays that cause ions to emit photons, which we see as ribbons of light. Perhaps NASA will give us some data from March 1st's outburst. You don't think they come from the inner Earth, do you? NASA managers have cleared the Space Shuttle Endeavour for liftoff on the 11th of March, on the first of three flights to deliver a huge Japanese research complex to the International Space Station. Barring last-minute delays, the flight would represent the quickest turnaround between shuttle missions since NASA resumed launches 2.5 years after the shuttle Columbia was destroyed on reentry into the atmosphere in 2003. The shuttle is scheduled to spend 2 weeks at the space station to install a storage room for Japan's Kibo Laboratory Complex and outfit the station's Canadian-built robot arm with a mechanical hand. Oil, heating oil, and gasoline prices spiked Tuesday as investors eyed the possibility that OPEC may cut production just ahead of the second quarter, when gasoline demands in the Northern Hemisphere usually become the central focus of the market. An explosion at a 70,000-barrel-a-day refinery in Texas may have also boosted prices, but the primary worry is that the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, may reduce output next month to support prices in an $85 to $100 a barrel range, said Tetsu Imori, commodity markets fund manager at the AST Max Futures Company in Tokyo. Given such a somber economic context, OPEC leaders are facing contradictory pressures, with much of the global economy sputtering and consumers reducing energy use. Imagine that. OPEC leaders appear baffled by rising oil prices. Meanwhile, Green Star Products today announced that it has successfully completed phase three for winter environmental testing of its hybrid algae production facility in Montana. The GSPI hybrid algae production system is designed to provide a controlled algae-growing environment at an affordable capital and maintenance cost, which has eluded engineers for more than three decades. For those of you that don't know the significance of this, that algae produces oil that can be turned into diesel fuel. Coming up on the 16th, we have Miriam Delicato coming on the program. She is going to discuss her new book and her contact with the tall, blonde ETs. The messages are amazing, so don't miss this one. This week, we have the author of The Way of the Explorer, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. He is a former astronaut who walked on the moon from Apollo 14. He also participated in a very exclusive experiment in non-local communication during that voyage. You are about to hear the epiphany of the century if you stay with us for the three-hour program tonight. I am a little bit out of sorts today. I had a long week trying to get this biodiesel plant up and running up here in eastern Washington State, so a little bit rushed coming into the studio tonight, and I apologize. My guest tonight, Dr. Mitchell, we have looked forward to having on the program for quite some time. His book, completely fascinating, as you will know when you finish this three-hour program. Dr. Mitchell, how are you?
I'm doing fine tonight. Thank you very much.
Well, I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on X Squared Radio.
Well, you're very kind. I'm pleased to be here.
We only have three short hours to discuss your work with this amazing book, The Way of the Explorer. And what I think I would like to do is start with your experiences on your Apollo 14 mission to the moon in the first hour, your explorations for understanding your incredible epiphany while still in space, maybe the second hour, and maybe bleed into the third. And then we'll delve into your discoveries about the human soul and how it might be connected to the universe in the third hour. I know that's kind of a loose structure, but we might be inspired to go somewhere else halfway through, and that's okay, too. Is that okay with you?
That's fine with me. Sounds good.
Wonderful. We will take phone calls all 3 hours during the program because we've had so many people write us emails about Dr. Mitchell. We know you all want to get your questions answered as well, so I will try to get them all in. We have an open format here on X Squared Radio, so we kind of float around and get a full 55 minutes of talking in before we go to commercials, and that way we can really delve into the deep subjects. Dr. Mitchell, only a dozen men have had the privilege of stepping onto another planet. You were one of them. And I'm sure that millions of little boys like me who dreamed of traveling into space, I would still go today, by the way, as would most of my friends, can you tell us how you made your dream of a mission to the moon a reality?
Brooks, I'm terribly sorry. I'm having a little trouble hearing you. You'll have to repeat the question, please.
Okay, I'll try to boost the volume just a little bit. I asked how you made your dream of conducting a mission to the moon or being part of a mission to the moon a reality.
Well, it all began. I really didn't plan on a career in aviation or a career in the military, but I was going to be, after I graduated from college in 1951, I was about to be drafted. The draft board notified me that I was to be drafted into the military during the Korean War. And I was already a pilot. I started flying when I was 13 and had a pilot's license at 16. And I didn't really want to go into the trenches in the Army. So I enlisted in the Navy and went through boot camp and officer school and then went through flight school with the Navy. And the Korean War got ended about that time, but I was still had obligated service to perform. And so happens I was on my way back from duty in the Pacific aboard an aircraft carrier with the U.S. Navy in 1957, October the 4th to be precise, when Sputnik went up. And I realized that humans were going to be right behind robot spacecraft to go into the heavens, and that sounded pretty exciting. So I reshaped my career plans and my destination to accommodate that, and ended up getting a Ph.D. from MIT along the way. And was finally selected into the Apollo program in 1966 to as one of the 19 astronauts selected then for the Apollo program.
Wow, that is amazing. Absolutely amazing. I know many people, there were probably many, many astronauts in that program. There is a time when you're training along with perhaps 50 other men for the same seat on a spacecraft. When you were running or venturing into new areas of physics for human survival in space, when did you know you were going to be chosen to go?
Well, I did not know until that I was being selected into the astronaut program. After I got my Ph.D. from MIT, I was in the technical director for what was called the Manned Orbiting Laboratory Program, a military space program that was ill-fated and didn't last very long. And when I got from that, I got to go to Edwards Air Force Base as a test pilot and go through the space school there, and with Chuck Yeager as my boss. And that was in 1966, and I was 65, and then I was selected in 66 into to the astronaut program as for the Apollo program, and that was the beginning of it, and felt very fortunate upon it because Edwards Air Force Base and the Air Force Test Pilot School was a major point of selection for astronauts at that point in time.
Well, did you get to, before the launch, did you get to work with the equipment? I mean, did you get to climb, you know, over the lunar module and climb up to the top of the scaffold holding those rockets before you got to go?
Well, what so, we really did there, when we went into the astronaut program, we were asked to select what area of technical specialty we wanted to work with. Didn't mean we were going to get it, but we were asked what we really want to work with.
Yeah.
And I chose to work with the lunar module. And so with Fred Hayes, astronaut Fred Hayes, I was sent to Grumman, back and forth, to Grumman Air Force Aircraft Factory in Long Island, New York, in Beth Bates, Long Island, to help be the astronaut representative during the final building and testing of the lunar modules at the factory. And when we finally delivered the first lunar module to Cape Kennedy for flight, and that was on Apollo 9, the first manned lunar module on Apollo 9, then we got transferred to start working on our own mission. And the routine at that point was that you went into you went into a backup crew and trained for the flight train for that mission. And then the procedure was, at that point, three flights later, you could be selected for a prime crew. And so I was on, then on Apollo 10, went to Apollo 10 as a backup crew, and presumably I would go to Apollo 13 following that assignment. And there's a story to that, too. But that was the way we did the exam.
Well, what was it like looking at that 363-foot-tall candle and the three little seats at the top?
Well, that's a wonderful experience to, you know, I knew Von Braun and the team personally. We got to talk with him, got to meet the engineers and people that worked on the spacecraft and helped build it. So we were very fully involved in the building, the testing, getting all the equipment ready, and that was quite a lovely and interesting experience, particularly if you were already schooled and skilled, not particularly skilled at that point, but schooled in spaceflight as we knew it. And I must point out to our listeners that this was in the 1960s, and at the beginning of the space curve in the 1950s, our knowledge of the heavens was about as sophisticated as God in the middle, God in the heavens, man in the middle, and everything else below. We really didn't have much idea what was out there.
Exactly. I was just going to ask, you know, other than working with the previous space flights and even moon launches, you know, how do you practice for space flight? I mean,
you don't.
That was
the whole point. For each one of us in those early days, it was a new experience. And best we could do was just the best we could do.
That's right.
We were test pilots. And to take a piece of machinery and ring it, put it through its paces. That's what it was all about.
Now, the three of you, Stuart Roussa and Alan B. Shepard, did you work together as a team from the very beginning, or did it just kind of sift down to you three?
Well, let me tell that little story. It's an interesting story. I served as backup crew on Apollo 10 with Gordon Cooper as the commander. And Gordon retired after that assignment, even though we were supposed to go to Apollo 13 at that point. And he retired, but Alan Shepard had been grounded with an inner ear problem. And he had that fixed and was coming back on flight status and was lobbying to get a mission and was lobbying to take Gordon's place when he retired. And that was approved, and we were then assigned to the Apollo 13 mission. But headquarters intervened and said, Alan, you haven't been training because you've been grounded with this problem. Best you take a little more training time, and you and your crew exchange missions with Jim Lovell, who was in Apollo 14,
mm-hmm.
and his crew, and you take a little more training time and get yourself a little better prepared for this. Well, that wasn't a very set. We weren't very pleased with that decision, but you don't argue with the boss.
Right.
So we ended up then getting ready for switch missions with Jim Lovell's crew, and of course they flew 13 and we flew 14, but they got the bad bird and we got the good bird. They had to come
there
back,
you go.
And we had to go. We got to go where they were going to go with that mission. So that's kind of the long story, long part of that story. And the fortunate part was that Ken Mattingly and I, who was the command module pilot on 13, he got bumped, if people recall, from the mission at the last minute because he had been exposed to the measles of Charlie Duke's children. And so Ken was on the ground, too. He had been replaced by his backup, Jack Swigert. And so all of a sudden, the whole complexion of the thing changed, that they had the bad bird, they had explosion in space, and Ken Mattingly and I were the two senior lunar module and command module pilots on the ground, and we spent the entire recovery time for Apollo 13 in the simulators, trying to work the problem before they had to do it in space to make sure that, because we didn't really have any experience using a lunar module as a prime propulsion vehicle and to come back to the Earth with. So that's kind of that long that version of that story.
So the three of you, Alan and Stuart and you, were sort of brought together, you know, rather late in the plan. So was it always business as usual with you three, or did you have a really good camaraderie? Did you have fun together while you trained on the mission?
Oh, yes. We had a good team, and Shepard was a good commander. He was a very bright guy, and Stuart was a very good command module pilot. So we got along very, very well. Now, as far as personality and style, we recognized that if there were 360-degree circle of personality, we were all 120 degrees apart, the three of us. But as professionals, we got along very, very well.
Sure, I understand. So, Pad A, Launch Complex 39, Kennedy Space Center, Florida, 4:03 p.m., January 31st, 1971, after an unprecedented 40-minute delay due to bad weather, that launch vehicle, along with the two-part Kitty Hawk and the two-part lunar module, rumbled to life for its one and only mission to the moon. What went through your mind during those last 2 minutes on the countdown?
Well, as you said, there was a 40-minute delay. And because of weather, and we had to sit it out for 40 minutes, and what I remember was when they resumed the countdown, that Alan Shepard said, "Mitch, wake up, we're ready to go." I dozed off in the midst of all that.
That
worked out fine.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. I like to hear that kind of stuff. So how long does it take to get off the launch pad and into space? You know, we kind of see the TV version with, you know, 10 different instant replays.
It takes about 10 and a half to 11 minutes from launch until orbit. And you go through at 363 foot of spacecraft and you dump two sections on the way, the first and second stages, and then use the third stage to get you on your way to the moon an hour and a half later.
Wow. Can you see out the window during the launch, or is it, you know, just pretty much have an instrument panel?
Yeah, as soon as the launch escape tower is jettisoned very shortly after launch, within the first 30 seconds or so, after you've got a firm launch going, and that protective cover is pulled away from the port so you can see out. Oh, that's a magnificent view. You can see up and down the coastline, and before we got away from it, you could see from Carolina down to Cuba, and then we were too far out to the ocean to see anything more, but that was magnificent.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, were there any events during the launch that caused you any fear? For instance, when the first stage explodes away from the service module, does it sound like a transmission changing gears, or does it sound like the engine fell through the floorboard out on the highway behind you?
Well, we call that particular event, the first stage separation and burnout, we call that the train wreck. because that's kind of what it felt like.
Oh, my gosh.
The describing it, however, is that it was, we have to remember that the spacecraft is 363 feet in height and starts out under 2G of pressure and builds up to about 4G during the first stage, which you're up over 30,000 feet and when the first stage burns out. But that 363 feet of metal has been compressing like a spring. And as I know, you're a physicist, and so it's been compressing like a spring, and you are suddenly, when the first stage shuts off, you've been pressed with four times your weight into the seat structure, and then it quits, and you feel like you're being thrown forward because of that.
Gotcha.
And then that 363 feet of metal decompresses, and it feels like you've been running over a rough washboard road. It bangs you in the back, like slaps you in the back, like a series of vibrations as the spring uncouples. And then the second stage cuts in and slaps you hard in the back again. So we call that particular maneuver the train wreck.
Now, do you go through that in the simulator?
Beg your pardon?
Do you go through that in the simulator?
Well, you can't really simulate that very well, but something like that, they shake it up a little bit so you can get the idea of it.
Yeah, I get the idea. It's a little more scary than when a jetliner takes off and they're accelerating hard to get off the runway, and then they immediately get to a preliminary altitude and they kind of let off the gas a little bit, and that difference in acceleration makes you feel like you're slowing down, but you're not.
Yeah.
Well, I understand from your book, The Way of the Explorer, that the lunar module settled down on the surface without any problems. I think we are always amazed at our own level of technology, but like you said, when we look back now and say, man, I can't believe you guys did that without so much as a digital calculator, you know, just before you opened the hatch to climb out on the surface of the moon, what were your feelings?
Well, there was interesting feelings getting down there. We had a few little tense moments getting there, but the real feeling was, okay, we're ready to go out. Let's get out there and get our checklist all together, the regalia all in place, checklist on one arm, a watch on the other, so that we could keep up and stay on time. And it was quite an adventure to step out on the surface, start to feel this other world that you're in, and you. Kind of amazed at all of that, but then reality starts to set back in, and you get busy trying to do your job, and that's what you're really all about, getting your job done.
Well, I understand that. I mean, you just train your whole life in a quasi-military environment to, you know, not really kid around, but, you know, stick with the plan and make sure that you're giving the government their best for their investment. You mentioned a journey that you had with Alan. While you're walking on the moon, you were climbing a slope to see what was on the other side. Tell us about your desire to get to the top of that ridge. What was that like?
Well, the first EVA, however, We were setting up science experiments. Our mission was the first real science mission. The Apollo 11 was just to prove that we could do it and get off safely. Apollo 12 to show we could land precisely where we wanted to and get off safely. And then we went to the aborted Apollo 13 site, and our mission was to start doing the first science on the moon. So we set up a science station on the first EVA and collected a certain amount of data from the soil and so forth. And then on the second one, we were due a geology traverse up an area to an area called Cone Crater, which was about 2 kilometers from our spacecraft, and we were to do that on foot. And do that on foot.
Right.
And then bring back photographs, bring back a lot of samples. We brought back almost 100 pounds of samples, so over 90, almost 99 pounds of samples, and about 1,000 pictures. And we really did the first geology experiments on the moon, and by climbing up to this area called Cone Crater.
Did you make it to the top?
Well, we made it to the top, except we didn't know it. We had the terrain was somewhat undulating, kind of like, almost like sand dunes.
And
you could not quite see the landmarks that the geologists wanted us to gather samples from. We knew we were headed in the right direction. We knew we were headed up Cone Crater. But the precise location of our was often quite a bit in doubt. And so we got to the top, thought we were at the top. We were up in the boulder field right on the rim of the edge of Cone Crater. But they, because we were so slow getting up there and had so much difficulty, we had to stop and turn back. Only later did we realize we were only about 50 feet away from the rim, but we still couldn't see the edge of it.
Oh, how about that?
That was really a bit of a disappointment, but we'd really accomplished all of our mission, so we couldn't complain too much.
Well, when you got to the top, did you turn around and try to take a view back over where you had been?
Oh, sure. We could see the lunar module sitting way down, way out there. We've got photographs of all of that. We could see the lunar module. We could see our way back down. And we had wonderful photographs of the heavy, big, heavy boulders that had been thrown out of this crater that we were looking at or were trying to find. And so it was, everything was successful. The only thing was our personal disappointment. We wanted to peer down into that crater. And that was a kind of a personal thing, but we accomplished all of our science objectives by getting up there and within just a few feet of the crater. But the real disappointment was that we couldn't look down in and see it.
Wow. So close. So close.
So close, exactly.
Do you ever go back and reminisce about that moment, just, you know, another 5 minutes you'd have been to the top?
No. Well, we did for a while, but then, you know, what more can you say? What more can you say? You...
That's true.
Did your very best. Circumstances weren't with us, and we ran out of time getting there. It was a little harder climb than we expected. And finally, Houston had to say, hey, guys, you better stop now and consider that the top of the crater and the top of the mountain and get your objective, get your samples, and come on back down. Well, we did, and 3 weeks later, after they did the results, turned out we were right where we were supposed to be, but we just couldn't see what we wanted to see.
Huh. Well, I guess you'd have had to hold your breath the rest of the way back, and that just wouldn't work, would it? So what did the stars look like from there?
Well, the point is, the stars, because like on Earth, during the daytime, the reflection on the lunar surface is so bright that you can't see the stars unless you look through a telescope or look through something like a toilet paper or paper roll that you roll paper on.
I see.
So that you can screen out the reflections off the surface. But the stars in space, not necessarily on the surface, but the stars in space are 10 times as bright as you can possibly see on Earth because of the lack of intervening atmosphere. When you're in space, there's not that atmosphere that makes the stars twinkle, and it cuts down on the dimmer stars. But when you're in space and not looking toward the sun, looking away from the sun, then the lights are bright and stars are magnificent and 10 times as bright as you can possibly see on the clearest night on Earth.
Wow. Well, I have a listener who wants me to ask. I guess you just answered it. If there were so many stars, how come there are no stars in the photographs? But now I see that the reflection of the sun off of the white dust of the moon would make the aperture of the camera close down, so you really
exactly
wouldn't see the stars.
The camera is just like your eyeball with a
right
bright light. In order to take a decent picture of what you're seeing, you have to close the aperture, and you get the aperture that shut down. It you can't see the stars, but if you could look through a telescope or something, you can see the stars well.
Well, tell us about Alan's golf shot. He took a moment to take a golf shot. How do you swing a golf club when you're in a spacesuit that's pressurized from the inside? How did he handle it? Did he have a special-made golf club, or was he just that good?
Well, how do you do it? Very clumsily. That's the answer. But he made a magnificent effort at it, and it was just the head of a golf club that we fitted onto. He fitted onto the piece of equipment that we used as part of the science equipment, and took a couple of whacks and buried one golf ball into the regolith, got the other one, pushed it out there a little bit, and I used a used piece of equipment for a javelin and threw it after his golf ball, so we had the first Lunar Olympics, one golf shot and one javelin throw.
Wow. So at 1/6 the gravity and no atmosphere, I bet that ball went a long way.
Well, that's been the claim, but I will have to admit you hit it on the head here, that the cumbersomeness of a pressure suit wasn't going to allow that golf shot to be very much of a, very impressive. But I'll have to admit, like most stories over the years, how far it went got better and better and better. And I had to pull out a photograph ever so often that showed my javelin went about 4 inches further than his golf ball to help keep things in perspective.
Pretty good.
Oh, boy. That was fun.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good, though. That's the human part of exploration. I would be remiss to the paranormal nature of this program if I didn't ask you if you or any of your teammates saw anything that was perhaps out of the ordinary, or was it just a cold, lifeless vacuum?
I have personally talked with virtually all the astronauts up through the Apollo and the Skylab program, and up through those programs, I can verify from personal accounts, we saw nothing untoward flying out there. We saw some things we couldn't identify immediately, but they were all eventually identified, and many of our astronauts, not me, I've never had a first-hand personal experience with UFOs, but many of the, I'll say several of the astronauts during their military career as pilots claimed to have been vectored in to chase alien craft and so forth. And never was able to catch any, but they had experiences like that. I never had such an experience.
Interesting. Well, we've got those questions out of the way. The part of this mission that kind of gets perhaps more notoriety than any of the other space missions is an experiment that you participated in. And I'm more interested in the hypothesis of the experiment and maybe the methods by which you conducted the experiment. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiment into ESP that went on? Who constructed the experiment and that approached you?
Well, I did, but in conjunction with two physician friends of mine, medical doctor friends, who were very interested in the subject matter as well, that I had met on vacation. And we put all this together in a rather ad hoc fashion just a few weeks before the flight itself. And I had been a student, or not a student, actually, but I had been studying J.B. Ryan's work and Carlos Osa's work in New York for quite some time, and was fascinated about it and realized that if this work was really as what it seemed to be and as powerful as it seemed to be, then we in science were derelict in not finding out more about it. And so my two physician friends said, let's just do an experiment. So we collectively put all that together in about 3 weeks before the flight with myself in space and four people on Earth. And what I really did was mimicked what Ryan had done in laboratories. I took a table of random numbers and took the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and put them on my knee board in random orientation in 6 different columns. And then we used the Zener symbols, so-called Zener symbols, star, cross, wavy line, circle, and square. And then in flight, I would take and assign the 5 Zimmer symbols to each one of the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. And on 4 different occasions, although we planned on doing 6, on 4 different occasions, during my rest period, I would take a look and assign the symbols to the numbers and focus on them, think about them for 10 to 15 seconds apiece, and go to the next one. And while my colleagues on Earth at that point were attempting to write down what they thought I had thought about and then the ordering. To make a long story short, real quick, I brought this back. I only did 4 experiments, although we expect to do 6 because I didn't have any more time. While my colleagues on Earth wrote down 6 sets of answers, so we brought this back, and I sent the results off to J.B. Ryan at Duke to check, and we came back with the results. So chance could have used a statistical measure. Chance could have produced our results 1 out of 3,000 experiments, which is respectable, quite a respectable result, about what you get in the laboratory at times. Then
so
the next thing
is about
the raw data. Then we next corrected for the fact that I only did 4 experiments, and my colleagues wrote down 6 sets of results. When we corrected for that error, these probabilities rose to 1 in 13,000 that chance could have produced our experiments, our results.
That's pretty statistically
significant. So that was considered a pretty good experiment.
Right. That's pretty statistically significant there, 1
yes,
in 13,000.
Mm-hmm.
So now you started conducting the experiment, or at least collecting the data for the experiment on the way out, right?
I'm sorry, I say that again, please.
On the way to the moon, you started collecting the data as you left Earth, and you
I did 2 experiments going out and 2 coming back. 2 sessions.
Okay. Now you spent some time on the moon. The lunar module spent how long on the surface?
We were on the surface 34 hours. Mm-hmm.
So you went back to the module and got more life support in your suit, and you had to take a rest period in the lunar module.
We were only on our 2 extravehicular activities, EVAs are called, were a maximum of 5 hours each, and we planned it for 4.5 hours, but we could never quite get everything done in 4.5 hours, so extended almost to 5 each time. So we had 2 periods on the surface of almost 5 hours each, but we were totally on the surface for 34 hours.
So while you were in
the spacecraft,
while you're in the lunar module, you have to take some rest.
Did
you find that difficult?
Beg your pardon?
Did you find it difficult to rest in the lunar module?
Well, we had hammocks that we strung in the spacecraft, one athwart ships and one back and forth, kind of like you do in a cramped up ship. We were Navy guys, so we're used to that sort of thing. But it was pretty cramped, but we made do.
Did you have feelings of instability, or were there any sounds outside?
Well, we did hear some sounds, which we thought were probably micrometeorites popping into the foil that was the heat insulation around the spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And we had landed a little bit on a slope, and so we had, when we were standing in the spacecraft itself, it felt like we might be leaning over. And when we were sleeping at night, there was really a sensation. So we knew we weren't falling over in any way, but a couple of times during the night, we got up to take a look and just doubly check and make sure we weren't capsizing at all.
Well, that's kind of hard to talk yourself out of in the middle of the night. It's like, hey, Alan, why don't you go outside and see if we're straight up and down?
Well, it wouldn't do that. We just kind of peek out the window and take a look, see if we were still stable.
That's interesting. I was, now, when the lunar module takes off from the moon, that's a lot faster event than taking off from Earth. It's not near as much gravitational pull.
Right, it's a little bit sportier ascent. Mm-hmm.
So it's more like an explosion than it is a liftoff.
Well, it's in lunar G. Remember, you're in 1/6 gravitation, so it's not any. It's really not any more challenging. And it's a shorter lived. The spacecraft is smaller. It's rather quick, and you're off and running and up into space fairly quickly. It didn't take nearly as long to get up there from the lunar surface as it does from Earth.
Could you see Stu and the command module going around the moon above you?
No, we couldn't see that, and we were so preoccupied with our own stuff that we didn't really try to do that. And he had his own task to do. He was mapping the lunar surface at that point, and he had plenty to do while we were gone. Only when we were ready to come back and start to get ourselves together did we start to really get concerned about, okay, where's Stu and what's he doing up there?
I got you. All right. Well, that's about all we have for this hour. I can't believe we've blown through it already.
Well, we did, didn't we?
It goes so fast in this program. It just blows my mind. We're going to take about a 3.5-minute break, and then we'll be back, and we'll go more into the grand epiphany that Dr. Mitchell had in his book. You've got to read this book, The Way of the Explorer. We'll be back after these messages. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secrets, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back.
The spice expands consciousness.
To X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future.
Vital to space travel. trapped.
We're here tonight with our guest, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's clear and cold out here on the Western Desert. We're glad that you're here with us tonight. In our first hour of this three-hour program, we discussed the lunar mission from an angle I hope you found interesting. We're not done with it by any means, because the most amazing parts of this mission are yet to come in this hour. As we reported here on this program, crude oil has topped the $100 a barrel price, and many experts say it is headed for $200 a barrel. I know you can't afford a $200 fill-up for each week's commute. You need every edge you can get. So I'm going to point out to you a product that will help. No, you don't add it to your gasoline. You add it to your oil one time. It's called TVT 24/7. It is an environmentally friendly oil energizer that reduces friction on iron surfaces to nothing under the most grueling conditions. Less friction means better mileage. Try it out. Go to the online store at x2-radio.com and order yours today. The phone lines are open this hour, so if you want to call in, the phone numbers are on the website at x2-radio.com and are also on the front page of the BBS Radio Network, which we are proud to come through, as well as the Steel Eye Media. Dr. Mitchell, I was completely captivated by the description of your return trip to Earth from the moon. All the fun stuff is over. You've packed up all your rocks you've taken off from the moon. And now you talk about a feeling that came to you. Let me read from your book. You say, this wasn't a religious or otherworldly experience, though many have tried to cast similar events in that mold. And you continue, the human being is a part of a continuously evolving process, a more grand and intelligent process than classical science and the religious traditions have been able to correctly describe. Now, if I might be able to read just a bit further, it says, this new feeling was elusive, its full meaning somehow obscured, but its silent authority affected me to the very core. Here was something potent, something that could alter the course of a life. Now, were you silently wondering if Stu and Alan were thinking the same thing?
Well, the answer is yes, but they were busy. My schedule was a little more relaxed after leaving the moon because as my job was a lunar module pilot, and I was responsible for the lunar spacecraft and the lunar surface activities, so I had a little bit more successfully completed on the way home, so I had a little bit more time to be reflective and to look out the window and gawk at the heavens. And now, that didn't have things to do. I did have things to do, but looking out the window was just an amazing thing, and perhaps it's important to set it up here so that the listeners get a feel for it. We were rotating to keep thermal balance on the spacecraft, on the sun, and what that caused to happen was every 2 minutes, the Earth, the Moon, the Sun would appear in the spacecraft window in a 360-degree panorama of the stars in the heavens. And that was an awesome sight because in space, the stars are 10 times as bright as they are on Earth because of the lack of intervening atmosphere. And so it was much closer to what you can see through a telescope from Earth, and more than you can see with the naked eye, even on the highest mountain on the clearest night. And I had studied at MIT, getting my doctorate, and I realized from my astronomy courses at Harvard and MIT that the molecules in my body and the molecules in the spacecraft and my partner's bodies had been prototyped in some ancient generation stars. That was standard cosmology, standard knowledge, that the star systems create the matter in our universe. And instead of intellectual knowledge, which I said, okay, that just intellectual, that'd be nice, I know that. But instead of that, I realized I was having a feeling viscerally about it. It was like I was connected to everything. It was just a feeling I'd never experienced before.
Mm.
And this continued every time I was, and it was accompanied by ecstasy, a bliss that was just palpable. I didn't understand what that was. And so this continued every time I had a break from my work and got the chance to look out the window. That's what was happening. But of course, it was I didn't understand it. I'd never had this experience. And I was a little hesitant to say anything because I didn't know what my partners were feeling, and they weren't looking out the window as much as I was. And so I had to mull and think about this. Well, it turns out, just a sidebar in retrospect, that anybody that had these experiences in space, they were very personal and private, and they were rather reticent to talk about them simply for this reason. They had never had such a thing before.
Right, but, right.
And so that was what it was. And only in many years, several years later, to answer your question, several years later, after we had had time to digest this and think about it, did we start to compare notes occasionally. And we all agreed it was a pretty wonderful experience to look at the heavens and from that perspective. At the time, however, I was really overwhelmed by it, and I realized that we humans had almost forever, as long as we were standing upright and looking at the heavens, had been asking ourselves the question, deep question, about who are we, how did we get here, where are we going, what's this really all about out here? And
how old were you at the time when you made your mission to the moon? How old were you?
I was 40. I was coming up on, it was 1971, and I was 40 years old, coming up on 41, and had never had such an experience. And I realized that our cosmology, as told by science, was probably incomplete and perhaps flawed, and our cosmology as told by our religious cultural traditions rooted in religion were archaic and perhaps flawed, and that maybe that now we as a budding spacefaring civilization, with us the first generation of spacefarers, maybe we needed to ask these ancient questions all over again, and there might be some new answers available from looking at it from this type of vantage point. So that was kind of the experience.
I know some people who have had a similar experience. One might call it an ascension experience, something that that literally, in just a very short amount of time, changes you. It just changes you forever.
That is correct.
And it's not like seeing Christ appear before you or anything, because I know even fewer people that have had that happen or even read about it. But there is this sort of looking evolution in the face and realizing that even if you existed in mortality for 200 years, it would be a microsecond, cosmically speaking.
Of course. And that's the big point, and as you, as a physicist, know that, as I know that, we start to look at geologic time, that our whole life on this earth, the period of human thought and habitation since the earliest days, is just a flash in geologic time.
But you had a very unique experience looking out that window. As a scientist, you're going, is my brain or my optic nerve actually picking up extra pieces of radiation, or is this more of the non-locality that we were experimenting with the ESP experiment? What were your thoughts?
Well, at that point, I didn't know. And that was when I was just enjoying the experiment, the experience. It was so refreshing, so, well, it was just powerful. And so I was just enjoying it. But then when I got home, I was prompted to dig into the literature. I could find nothing in science and nothing in the religious literature. And that mystified me because it was such a powerful experience, I couldn't turn loose of it. So I, since I couldn't find anything on my own, and I've had other work to do, other things to do, I enlisted the help of some scholars over at Rice University, a nearby university in Houston, to see if they could help me get an answer to all of this. And so they came back to me a few weeks later, I don't remember how long now, but it was a couple of 3 weeks, and said, try this on for size. And what they read me was a translation of some of the ancient Sanskrit, which described an experience called Salvakalpa Samadhi, which means that you see things in their separateness and individually, like we see them with our eyes when we look, but you experience them internally and viscerally as a unity, as a oneness. And I said, man, that's exactly what I was feeling, a connection with the stars, connection with everything, in love with nature, with the universe. It was just incredible. And so that really answered my question as to what had happened, that these were type of experiences that go back in history. And that set me on the path then of trying to talk with different people and different cultures, and try to particularly find out spiritual leaders, like in the Hawaiian culture, the kahuna, or the shaman, or the witch doctor, or the medicine man, who was the spiritual leader in these particular communities, and see if I could find out firsthand what they thought about things. And my results were that in every culture, some type of experience, like we're just talking about, is in the lore, in either the verbal lore or the written lore, if it's a recent enough experience. But there's, in every culture, these type of experience. And then I realized as I studied more of this, that the experience is the same the world over, but the way it's described is quite different. And it's quite often. And the difference in the description is the cultural description of it, and that's the basis of religion. That the experience that we have is really the same. You know, I quote the Christian, like Jesus, 40 days in the desert and had his epiphanies there and his insights there. And every culture, there's something similar to that. And so I came to realize that was a very common experience, and as a scientist, I was saying, okay, what is it in nature that allows us to have this sort of experience? And so that was my introduction and my interest in developing the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is my foundation when I started, came back.
Right, right.
Because it was asking and bringing the tools of science to study consciousness and study what's going on here? What's this really all about?
Well, what's fascinating is that, you know, only 12 men, plus the ones that got to circle the moon while those were, you know, making footprints on another planet, got to go into space and get separated from the atmosphere of Earth, but it really didn't seem to make a difference, did it? I mean, you saw that your very existence was connected with the movement and even the formation of planets and stars and galaxies.
Well, and you know, I think that's what the ancient mystics have been trying to tell us forever, is that somehow there's a mysterious interconnectedness to everything. And this experience that has been common throughout all traditions at some point in history is a similar type of experience that gives you the visceral internal feeling of this unity with nature, unity with all of nature, unity with everything that we see. And that's kind of what this experience was all about.
I completely understand. And you know, as scientists, you know, we're fairly convinced that given enough time, all matter in the universe will quietly settle down to the molecular weight of iron. Given the age of the universe, it is plausible to expect that higher order atoms are formed during supernova events, when star systems explode.
Yeah, the heavier stuff has to be formed in supernovas, exactly.
Yeah, it's got to be put together with some kind of energy event. It doesn't happen on its own.
That's right.
So
yeah.
do you see an energetic entanglement of the matter that makes up our planet and our bodies?
Yes, and that's what we can talk about later, because that's what's come out of all of this in the final analysis. After we start to look at that type of phenomenon and start to understand, we, since Cartesian times, 400 years ago, we really haven't consciousness and what goes on in consciousness has not been a viable subject for scientific study. It's a no-no. But we're now starting to see, hey, we got to do something differently than we're doing it then.
Right, right. Why do you think that it's a no-no? I mean, I understand collecting data. I understand, you know, making it out and putting it together piece by piece and putting together instruments to measure things. But we're not really used to using our bodies to take measurements, right? We're used to using instruments.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, the history, if you want the history that's pertinent here, is the fact that back before Descartes and Newton and Helmholtz and all the greats of the late 16th, early 17th century, you know, the Inquisition was burning people at the stake for disagreeing with the Church, and Copernicus was fortunate enough to pass on before he announced his heliocentric theory of Earth and the Sun was announced. And Giordano Bruno took the heat for him and got burned at the stake. So the Cartesian conclusion that René Descartes came out of being a cardinal of the Church came to the conclusion that body, mind, physicality, spirituality belong to two different realms of reality that didn't interact. Well, that served the very noble purpose of getting the Inquisition off the backs of the intellectuals of the period and allowed science as we understand it to arise, provided it stayed away from subjects of mind, consciousness, spirit. Those were the realm for the Church, or for philosophers and theologians.
Right.
And so we proceeded down that path now for, proceeded down that path for 400 years. And with consciousness and mind stuff as a no-no for science. And only with the beginning of quantum mechanics in the 20th century did we really start to discover that mind and matter do interact, and that maybe that Cartesian conclusion is not quite correct. So that's where we are at this point in time, and it's taken throughout the 20th century, because that dogma that mind and consciousness is not an appropriate subject for science to run its course, and for the 80 years since quantum mechanics was formed in the early 20s, it's been the dogma that science does not look at things we call consciousness, and that quantum mechanics only pertain to subatomic matter, which it turns out now is just dead wrong.
Yeah, it does. I recall one time I was at Virginia Tech, and I was doing some scanning electron microscope work, and we were using some super cooled samples, and I was kind of fascinated by it. I wanted to see what an electron cloud looked like, and when I started getting the magnification up there, and I didn't see what I expected to see. I thought that I would see, you know, little busy electrons and clouds and little Borean orbits going around this nucleus. And that's not what I saw at all. What I saw were little electrons blinking in and out of existence. They were like popping in and out like little fireflies. And
yeah, but I didn't, quite a different thing.
Yeah, I didn't think about it much at the time, but I thought, you know, is that really the same electron that left that's coming back, or is that another electron, and where are they going?
Yeah, when we get down to that level in quantum mechanics, it's a very strange world down there, we now understand.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, you talk in depth about the zero point in your book as though we are all part of it or came from it. And I know this is too much to answer with one question, so we'll spend some time on it. If we go into the next hour with this, that's fine. Since it's basically one eternal round, what's the best place to start with this zero point?
Well, if we want to... I guess we better define our terms if we're going to talk about it. The zero point, or the zero point field, goes back to the turn of the last century. Several things happened at that point. First of all, most of the physicists of the late 19th century thought all of the laws of physics had been discovered and were not even encouraging students to take physics at that point because there really wasn't anything more to discover. How wrong they were. A lot more to discover, as it turns out.
Oh, yeah.
And Max Planck, at that point, learned about black-body radiation and saw that radiation was being emitted from all physical bodies. That was called black-body radiation because it radiates more, and that all matter was emitting quanta. He gave up the name quanta of energy, which are photons. Einstein later gave them the name photons. But in any event, that little energy was being given off in the form of photons or light. And then Einstein wrote the paper shortly after that, in the early 1905, is I think correct, that settled the argument that had been going on for centuries about the nature of light. Was it particle or was it wave?
Uh-huh.
And Einstein came to the conclusion that it really depended upon the experiment that you did with it, that the light was either particle or wave, depending upon the experiment, and it conducted itself, that it was really both. And very shortly thereafter, the physicists of the period realized that not only was that true of light, but it was true of very small particles, the subatomic matter, atoms and below. And so that was the beginning of getting formulated what's now called quantum mechanics. It didn't get formulated until the 1920s with a whole different new set of rules that we now still know are very, very strange, and that place in nature is quite different than classical physics that most of us learned in high school.
Sure.
Or in college.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of it. But for the 80 years since the formulation, it's been the dogma, still holding on to this old dogma, that science doesn't study consciousness, and that quantum principles, as strange as they are, really only pertain to subatomic matter. And it turns out that's not true either. So here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, studying consciousness and looking at a whole host of things that nobody would touch even 60 or 70 years ago.
Yes, I kind of know a little bit about that. I've got a little expedition of my own putting together, and it's got no small amount of consciousness aspects to it that I'm having to deal with. So what's the totality of consciousness?
Well, I wish I knew that. That's still the great enigma. And of course, my personal take is that I don't really, of the two extremes, let's go to the extremes.
All right.
The extreme on the one side is the extreme that says that consciousness is the fundamental stuff and the only stuff. and that matter is simply a product, mind stuff is simply that there's no real substance to matter, it's just a thought. Now that's an extreme interpretation of a so-called idealist concept of consciousness.
Yeah, in other words, all physical matter is just an illusion.
It's just an illusion, exactly.
Right.
But, okay, that's one extreme. The other extreme is the far extreme of materialism, which says that consciousness is an epiphenomenon, which means it's just an accidental byproduct of matter. And, of course, that's the other extreme. Well, I take the position that both of those extremes are wrong, that the truth is somewhere in between, and that our job is to try to really find out what that in-between is, and that as a space-faring civilization, let's see if we can do a better job of finding out what this is all about.
Yeah, that there ostensibly is some balance between strings, if that's what you want to call them, vibrations, energy coming together in agreement to form subatomic particles, which then form atoms and then molecules and on and on and on. But if that's the case, then you're exactly right. There's some kind of common toolbox, as it were, that all the subatomic particles are made from, and that the energy that makes up that matter has to, in some respect, be common. It has to be in communication with one another.
That's right.
You know, whether we're conscious that we're conscious or not, we are, you know, sentient beings that happen to be having a mortal experience at the moment.
I proposed several years ago, in 1995, as a matter of fact. I was at a conference at Cambridge University in England, at a conference called Beyond the Brain, in which I was delivering a paper which I proposed a model that I called a dyadic model, as opposed to dualism, the Cartesian dualism, where body-mind are separate things, or wave-particle duality, where waves and particles are separate things, to say, no, that's not really the way to look at it, that the right way to look at energy-matter and information is if they're two faces of the same thing. And I call that a dyad as opposed to a dualism. And on based upon this rationale, that we live in a universe that exists because of its matter, but it turns out we also know because of information. And its most basic definition of information is just patterns of energy. So we have frozen or solid energy, we call it matter, and we have patterns of energy, we call it information. And we live in a universe that exists and knows itself through us. And using that as an approach, we can start to look at these types of dualisms and issues that we haven't looked at before. And when I had delivered that paper, a physicist from the CERN laboratory in Switzerland, that had been a physicist there, had been listening to me give the paper, and came up afterwards and said, you know, I think one of our colleagues in Germany has just discovered something in the last few months that puts meat on the bones of what you're talking about and validates what you're saying. And I said, well, if that's so, let's go have lunch and talk about it. So I went to have lunch with a scientist, actually a technical person from CERN, Dr. Peter Marsher in England. He just retired from there. And he told me about what's now called the quantum hologram. And I was absolutely flabbergasted when he started telling me about this, because what it is, and have you heard about this book?
I have read a few papers on it, but I'm curious. I want to know your take on it, because you're on the ground, and then we'll discuss it.
Okay. Yeah, well, what he described to me was that Professor Walter Schimpf at the University of Siegen in Germany had just recently, at this time, that was 95, just recently, while working on MRI machines, he essentially was an MRI expert and really developed what's now called functional MIR, fMRI, and using, discovering what he called in the quantum hologram. Now, what it is, very simply stated, Max Planck discovered the radiation from all bodies, but for these 80 years or so, physicists have primarily looked at how subatomic matter and atomic matter splits and recombines, and Shimp was looking at something different. He was looking at group theory. He was saying, okay, what does the emission from any physical object tell us as a whole? Because he was trying to get better MRI. And in the process, he discovered and named this thing what he called the quantum hologram. And it merely was using Planck's black body radiation theory and then saying that if you study this as a group theory, now let's pin that idea down. What that means, like our fingerprints, if you look at the swirl on the tip of your finger, it doesn't tell you much about you. But if you look at the swirl on the pattern of swirls on all 10 fingers, it uniquely identifies you as your fingerprint. And what Shimp discovered was that the emissions from any physical object, when taken as a group, a whole group, carries unique information about that physical object. And it's non-local information. It's truly quantum-based information. And in this zero-point field we talk about. And
well, that's pretty fascinating. I was talking with Dr. Bruce Lipton just a few weeks ago.
Yes.
I asked him a question because he had said something about, the way cells decide and what they're going to divide into, whether they're going to be bone or eye tissue or, epithelial cells. And he gave me an answer that prompted two questions. He said that, well, it draws the information from the cell next to it. That's how it knows, what to be. And I said, okay, I have two questions then. First of all, what does the cell do that dies right at the interface between ligament and bone or between eye tissue and muscle? How does it know which to be? And the second is, what happens when there's only two cells, a sperm and an egg? How does it know to become all the differentiated cells that make up a human system? And here was his answer. This was really fascinating. He said that they have an image, an electromagnetic image of a fetus just after gestation, and the cells are actually filling in the electromagnetic image with 3D matter. I said, you got to be kidding me. You mean that there's sort of a spirit image of that fetus that's genetically pretty close to what it's going to be, and the cells know to differentiate from dimension to another?
Yep.
And he said, that's exactly right.
Well, now we can carry that idea on further here, because it's rooted right in what we were talking about. And it shows that that evolution, not only biology, but all matter, is a learning system, that it interacts with its environment and adapts to its environment because of this exchange of radiation of every physical object with its environment. And it's an adaptive learning system. And
well, that would imply that there's some kind of congenital feedback that allows the being to evolve.
Well, it certainly implies there's an awful lot more complexity in here that we really know what it is. And there's a lot more intelligence, information exchange going on than we really know what it is. For example, I like to use an analogy to get the idea across. When you go into any great cathedral that's been standing for 100 years or certainly 1,000 years, there's a sense of hush, of awe, of reverence that you feel when you immediately walk into it. And you can ask the question, why is that so? Well, the answer is because for 1,000 years, 100 years, or 1,000 years, for however long, people have gone into the structure on their best behavior with a feeling of awe, reverence, hush, and so forth. And that quantum hologram, or that field of information, that field goes into the structure and is fed back out to subsequent generations. So it's a learning process.
Yeah, I see that. I walked into Roslyn Chapel, which is in the little town of Ross Lynn in Scotland, and it's old. It's, you know, 1344, 1360, somewhere in there.
That's right.
There's something else that could be said about these old religious edifices, and that's that not only did people go in with their best intentions, but they went in with prayers for their own, you know, their own future, their own crops, their own health. They were yearning. They were, you know, stretching out their consciousness with all of their intention for answers.
That's the key word. They were putting intentionality into them. Exactly right.
Right.
So and intentionality has powerful effects. As we're
learning. Well, in physics, you know, we call this the observation effect. It's kind of a catch-all now, but this wave-particle duality that you're talking about, it was so hard to nail down for a long time.
Yep.
Even Schrodinger, you know, made his famous Schrodinger's cat paradox about it, that once you look at something, you can't tell simultaneously its speed and position. Now, that's kind of a mathematical catch-all, but...
Yeah, there's a matter.
It proves that our intention alters the reality. It alters the very energy that we're observing.
Yep.
So it's impossible for us not to be involved. Now, the case might be said that, well, humans haven't been around forever, and since we're, you know, one of the only intelligent beings on this planet, that's just impossible. It doesn't hold any water. But that takes a vast assumption that we've only existed here.
Wrong assumption, right?
That's right.
And that's all true. As a matter of fact, just to go apart the field a little bit, I have in my studies over the years studied the healing phenomenon, as you saw that in my book.
Right.
And I have been personally used alternative techniques for healing and prostate cancer and kidney cancer. I'm convinced I gave those things to myself to show that I could get rid of them with alternative means, and have done so.
Well, that's that is part of it too. You know, sometimes biological systems go wrong, and the self-healing mechanisms that we have normally in place in our body fail. And then disease or anomaly or some physiological breakdown happens, and we die well before our time. Well, we don't like to see that happen with ourselves, let alone someone else. And sometimes certain individuals have learned to master their intentionality to the point that they can actually extend healing to others.
That's right. Exactly right.
Now, you have a couple of stories in your book. One of them is very close to you, in your family, if you want to share those.
Yes, I have. Sure. Well, that was one of the things that turned me on to doing the things I've studied for the last 30 years, is that I went to a conference in Little Rock, Arkansas, very shortly after I'd returned from my flight, and at this conference in healing, lecturing, was a Tibetan Buddhist healer by the name of Norbu Chin. He's now deceased. But, and I was pretty skeptical of all that. I thought, being a pretty good scientist, I was pretty skeptical of those sort of things. But it so happens that my mother had driven over from Oklahoma about 3 hours away from Little Rock, and mother was suffering with glaucoma and was technically legally blind without her glasses. Her prescriptions, her eyesight was about 2200, which is virtually legally blind. Thick old glasses. And so this guy was claiming to be a healer, and my devious little mind said, well, let's get he and mama together and see what's going on here. So I asked him and I asked her. They were both amenable. Mom was a good sport. So they went up to we got them to my suite that night, that evening, and he did his mantra, his little healing mantra, and his prayer, his sounds, getting his vibes up, as it were. And after about 20 minutes, I said, Mrs. Mitchell, please go to your room, treat yourself as though you've had major surgery, have a little grape juice and broth, and let's see what tomorrow brings. Well, my mother is a very fundamentalist Christian, but she was a good sport and wanted to see all this. So she came into my room, waked me up at 6:30 the next morning, her Bible in one hand, her glasses in the other, praise the Lord, I can see, I can see. And I came up out of a dead sleep, still groggy, and just, well, that's wonderful, Mama. And she then proceeded to read from her Bible without her glasses. Praise the Lord, I can see. Dropped her glasses on the floor, ground them under her heel, broke them, and was happy as a clam. And, of course, what I had to do, I invited Norbu to come live with me in Houston so I could figure out what he was doing. But that's not the end of the story. Mother then drove home, or 200 and some miles, back home, sans glasses, legally blind from point of view of all records. And this went on now for a week. I called her every day, and, Mom, how are you doing? How's the eyes? Oh, son, they're fine. Praise the Lord. I can see. A week later, she called me, and as soon as I picked up the phone, I could tell something was wrong. And I said, Mom, are you all right? What's the matter? And she said, son, you tell me, is Norbu a Christian? And I knew the jig was up. I knew what was going to happen. I didn't want to answer. And she was insistent, son, is Norbu a Christian? And I said, Mom, no, Mom, he's a Buddhist, but he's a very good man. And he hadn't come to live with me at that point. He did later. I studied him more. And she said, oh, I've been healed by Satan. And I said, oh, Mom. Well, the upshot was she rejected her healing. The next day she had to go get her Coke bottle glasses again.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, she didn't get her glaucoma back, but she couldn't see. Now, the sequel to the story is that she lived another 10 years. And before she passed on, her eyesight had returned to where she was. Her glasses were just very light reading glasses. Her eyes continued to improve. She was a very bright woman. And she realized, of course, well, I rejected that healing. I turned loose. I cut it off. I should be able to get it back. So with her own mind, with her prayers or whatever, she was able, before she passed away 10 years later, to where she was almost had perfect eyesight again.
How about that?
That was one of my first, that got me truly interested in the power of this notion of remote healing and energy healing that I've studied a lot in the time. And I did have Norbu come and stay with me, and I watched him do it. I brought NASA physicians in to watch him perform, and so we did a lot of good science at that time.
So what did the, quote, scientists think of Norbu's ability to bring perhaps what they see or what exists beyond their physical reality and what they perceive as physical reality into their reality?
Well, it was too complicated, so they just mostly dismissed it completely. except me, I didn't. I've been working with it all these years, and we do know that... That everybody has this capability to a certain extent, like everybody is psychic to a certain extent, just like our great mathematicians and artists and scientists. We all have our talents, and some have these sort of talents, but we all can do a little bit of everything. And so it's just a matter of training, learning, and of course you're born with certain capabilities, but these are capabilities in the species that we're talking about that have manifest, and I'm sure it's a part of our evolutionary path.
Well, you mentioned another sort of dichotomy earlier in the program, and one which people think is perhaps at the opposite ends of the spectrum of light, and that is the difference between belief and knowing.
Yeah.
in the, I'm going to call it the early religiosity, where government got interested in religion, not necessarily God, but more interested in religion.
Religion, exactly.
They used fear, and they used ignorance and their power over literacy to govern nations and to keep them in a darkness which we now in history call the Dark Ages.
Yep.
But they systematically, with their armies, hunted down the knowers, people who knew. They used to call them Gnostics. It is Latin for to know or knowing.
Yep.
But the reality is that if you believe something, and then you discover a fact or you have an experience that gives you knowledge, then you no longer have to believe it, do you? You know it then, right?
Yep.
So then you can just stand on the knowledge and then believe to the next point until you gain the same experience, right?
Well, now we're starting to push a little bit.
Well, I'm just what I'm trying to get to is,
yes, in principle.
There's some kind of knowing that goes on.
Yep,
with an enlightened being,
yep,
and whether they're human or otherwise, that puts us in touch with this ability to heal ourselves and others. Is that what you feel as well?
Yeah. Certainly, there are those who have these deep insights. We call them enlightened people. Certain psychics have this capability. No doubt about that. The real problem is, of course, that these abilities, even though they may have the ability, they don't necessarily, and they know how to use it, they don't necessarily have the right explanation as to how it is working. And there's a lot of charlatans out there that pretend to have these things that really don't. So there's a lot of pitfalls. What you're saying in its purest sense, I believe, is true. But there's a lot of pitfalls in trying to decide what's really real. And fortunately, that's what science has, for the last 400 years, supposedly been about, is to help us, through experimental evidence, try to discern what is true. But it also grinds very slowly, and with a lot of pitfalls in it also.
Well, in your, with noetic sciences, you obviously have not only attracted a lot of inquiries in that area, but you've also made a lot of inroads and discoveries in that area.
Yes.
What's your litmus test? How do you tell between the charlatan and the genuine article?
Well, there is certainly just experience, and one of the more fundamental principles that values that we humans have to rely upon is integrity. And it takes a while to recognize when integrity is operating. But again, here's something. Eventually you really know if this situation or this person is operating full of integrity. And there's really no way, there's no really objective measure that I know of. Except honesty and truth and these sort of things that helps you discern integrity. But it is the fundamental characteristic that those who are dealing in these rather strange areas have to have in great measure if they're going to be successful. Otherwise, there is a lot of charlatanism, and we know there's a lot of that out there.
Well, sure. I mean, if you go to just about any convention or expo, you're going to run into somebody who has on their business card intuitive healer or something like that. And for me, and I'm maybe just a little bit more pragmatic, although I'm not dogmatic about it, when I see that on the business card, that's one of my litmus tests right there. I'm trying to look for the person who treats it as a gift instead of a living.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. And it's always, well, we just go through life doing these things. We're doing the best we know how. And that's the tools of science. We're experimental method. Even though we have a lot of things that don't we can't do an experiment on quite well. It's still the best method we've invented to make sure over a period of time that we're not being misled by the political system that, or the religious system that would tend to take us into areas just for power's sake and control's sake, power and control.
Do you get the feeling that maybe anciently, when we didn't have the ability to travel the way we do, we didn't have the ability to communicate the way we do with instantaneous communication around the globe, or to purify water or any of that, that maybe these abilities were required in every village, and perhaps those people who had that ability were highly respected and sought after?
Yep. That's quite true. That was true. And it didn't mean... And the whole knowledge base was much more limited at that point. As our knowledge base has become more complex as we've evolved, and if we've had more ways to discern nature and expand it out across the globe and expand it into the heavens. I like to tell a little story just to help get our period in perspective. Bear with me a minute.
Sure, sure.
My great-grandparents went across from South Georgia to Texas in the 1870s after the Civil War to start a new life. Covered wagons, pulled by horses, a few head of cattle to start a herd. Railroads weren't complete across the South and the West. Automobiles hadn't been invented. Electric lights hadn't been invented. My father was born just shortly after the Wright brothers made the first flight in an airplane. And I went to the moon. From covered wagons to the moon in less than 100 years.
Right.
But you know history, and for the thousands of years that humans have been around before what we would call the modern period, the Industrial Revolution, automobiles, et cetera, since the last century. People, horseback, footback, camelback, goatback, or whatever, but in 100 years, and I'm 77 years old, so just a little bit more than my current lifetime, from covered wagons to going to the moon. And that is our modern period, and it's phenomenal.
Well, it is, and one might say, gee, what do the next 100 years have for us? And if we don't...
Well, that is, are we going to last that long? Eating up our environment and our non-renewable resources at such a rapid pace and multiplying itself at such a rapid pace? We've gone from less than 2 billion people at the beginning of the 20th century to 6.5 billion into the 21st century. And our environment is being destroyed rapidly. And we have greed like gangbusters. The only thing anybody wants is money. And the gap between the have and the have-nots is getting worse. Climate change is creeping upon us. Hey, we got a lot of problems on our hands. We've got to have to look at.
Well, that's true. I mean, when you talk about a biological system that's now been discovered to operate with a feedback mechanism, what you end up with in any population, even if it's mathematical, you will end up with a fractal stratification.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what's happening to the human race.
Exactly right. So we got opportunities and we got amazing technologies, but we also got some severe problems we got to resolve.
Yeah, well, we're going to try and solve them in the next hour.
Okay.
Yeah, we could do it. We can do it right here on X Squared Radio. We can definitely do it. So we are going to take a quick break, about 6.5 minutes, and then we'll be right back with more of X Squared Radio. So don't go away. We'll be back after these messages.
We up now?
Friends down at NRG Resources have introduced the new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get to Miles Technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio.
Despite extends life.
This is our third hour. As we come to you from frozen upper desert of the western part of eastern Washington State, we enjoy your presence here with us tonight, and we appreciate it more than you know. I wanted to give you a little bit of an update on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. It appears that we have not met our funding goals for this year. And so, however, we did have our effect, because after a 13-city tour, speaking with various groups around the country, more than 10,000 people, and being on the air now for 3 years, 2 years talking about this expedition, that the charter companies that lease the Yamal, which is the nuclear-powered Russian icebreaker that is the only ship on the planet capable of making this journey, has been booked up 2 months in advance, the first time ever in the more than 10 years they've been running those expeditions or those tourist groups up in the Arctic region. And so we kind of shot ourselves in the foot, even though we probably could have made this summer. We knocked our own selves out of the running by increasing the popularity of that region of the planet by so much that the charter companies have taken all the available spaces for the next summer. As you know, nobody travels to the Arctic Circle after August because the Northwest Passage will completely freeze, and even the Yamal can't get through that. So we are now slated for 2009, and we promise to not give up. We will continue to raise funds. We will continue to raise public awareness that we want to make this journey and conduct these experiments and take these measurements above the Arctic Circle to see if we can test the hypothesis that the Earth might be a little bit more than what we think it is. I do want to remind you that this is the third hour of a three-hour program, and you can call in toll-free anywhere, United States and Canada. The number is 888-228-4494. Anywhere else on Earth, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. The number is 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185. For those of you that are using the internet for your telephone and you're using Skype, you can get to us by just putting in BBS Radio. If you're using PalTalk, it is BBSRadio_com. We have a lot of lines. You can call in and ask Dr. Mitchell or myself a question about this most important subject. Before I get into the next hour, I want to ask Dr. Mitchell if he has a website he would like to steer everyone to.
Absolutely.
And that would be?
Okay, there's several. Ed Mitchell, Apollo 14, numeral 14.com. Noetic.org or Quantrek.org, Quantrek.org. Those are my two foundations and my own personal website.
All right, excellent. And the book that I've read is The Way of the Explorer. It was actually published a while back, and then it was recently edited, a revised edition, and there's a lot of good stuff in here. Where is the best place where they can find this incredible book?
Well, it's on Amazon. It also can be ordered from me, but it's also now in most of your popular bookstores like Borders and Barnes & Noble.
Well, that's good. I highly recommend the book. Now, in this hour, we're going to try to solve all the world's problems, but first of all, we're going to try to raise a little awareness here. You say in your book, let's see here if I can find this, is it valid to say, well, there are many people that make the assumption that it's valid to say we are no more under intentional human control than we have ever been, except for the fact that we now have one or more mortal experiences to perhaps imbue us with some wisdom. How do you feel about that? I mean, you say we've gone from covered wagon to space travel in less than 100 years, and that prior to that, we were on horseback or footback for the previous however long, 40,000,
yes,
6,000,
right, yeah.
100,000 years. What about it? Is this the age when humans will affect the planet, or have we been here before?
Well, I don't know whether we've been here before. There's certainly some suggestions that maybe our origins are not what we thought they were, and that has yet to be determined. But the interesting thing is that in the period of the last 400 years since the beginnings of classical science, as it has slowly wound its way, well, even before the fall of the Roman Empire, the Enlightenment, then the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we have, at the beginnings of science, we have been building ourselves up with more and more knowledge and more understanding of the way the larger universe works. And, of course, those have had the privilege of looking at the some of the Hubble telescope pictures of the deep heavens and the deep faraway galaxies and galactic clusters are certainly mind-blowing and giving us a totally different view of this magnificent universe that we're a part of. So it's not surprising that we would have a different perspective than our ancestors even 100 years or so ago.
Well, even my proctor, when I was, studying for my PhD, said that, you know, the universe is cooling, we came from this Big Bang, and way, way out there, you know, will be chaos in the early image of the universe, and once the Hubble telescope gets up there, we're going to look out there, we're going to see the very edge of the universe.
Right.
So when they did the deep space shot and all these organized galaxies come back way, way out there, there were a lot of very confused professors because they'd been teaching it for a long, long time.
That's exactly right.
So, there's a book, a big black book. If you get a chance, you should find it in a used bookstore somewhere. It's called Gravitation. And somewhere around page 148 in there, they talk about the balloon universe, how the universe is made up like a balloon, and all the galaxies are like pennies glued on the surface of the balloon. And it even shows an animated picture of a man blowing up the balloon, and that's how all the galaxies are moving away from each other.
Right, yeah.
And one of my associates, his name is Nassim Haramein, has an amazing DVD series out. He says, well, that's all well and good, but who's the guy blowing the balloon up?
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, I think we have a lot to learn yet, and we'll learn a lot more here over the next century or two. It's coming at us faster and faster and faster. And one of the things that I don't want to dwell on this because it's too complicated, I think, for us tonight, but this whole work that I've been working with quantum holography is suggesting, and I have a brand new book right here from one of my colleagues that's in Europe called From Zero to Infinity. And it's looking like the very formalism that helped us understand this quantum holographic reality that we're banking on these days also shows us how matter can arise right out of the zero-point field that we haven't talked very much about, but that is there, and it looks like it's creating matter continuously, and perhaps the brown, the dark energy, and even the dark matter may very well be coming from quite a different source than we think it is.
Well, that's interesting, because the realization that when we look at all the matter that we can see, it only makes up about 5 or 5.5% of the universe.
Exactly.
The rest of the universe is matter we can't detect just yet.
Exactly right. Yep.
So either that matter exists, or it exists in another dimension, but somehow its effects are being felt in our reality.
That's true. That's exactly true. And there's just so much we don't really know yet.
Yeah, but we're getting close.
We're getting closer.
Getting
closer.
There are many that feel as you do in your book that ultimately the promise of our technologies lies in our eventual escape from a dying planet. How are we doing with our planet, do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think, that's a ways into the future. Of course, we may be killing off our planet ourselves with our unsustainable ways, but provided we're able to get past that one, our solar system has about another 5 billion years it could survive if we don't mess it up completely, and we have that long to get off. So we've got to, in that period, either learn to get outside of our universe and onto another part of the galaxy somewhere onto more stable stars or some such thing. But realizing that we live in a finite universe and a finite space that has a finite lifetime is a rather important part of understanding all this.
Well, do you share the feeling of many that this planet is somehow, in some respect, a living thing with whom we coexist in space?
Well, the notion of, yeah, the Gaia notion that Lovelock came up with three decades ago, I think is very viable. We have to think of everything in our universe as, in some sense, a far more complicated and far more close to a living system than we ever thought it was in the past. That part is true. Exactly how it all fits together, that's still a big puzzle.
Wouldn't you like to go to the Arctic Circle with us next year?
I did go to the Antarctic this last year, been a year ago, because I wanted to go down and see for myself just how this climate change, I prefer to use the word climate change instead of global warming because it's clear that whatever the process taking place isn't affecting everybody the same.
Right.
But I wanted to go down, and there's not much question, but there's some pretty powerful stuff going on down there.
Interesting. What time of year did you go?
Well, I went in the Antarctic. I went in the end of January last year, which was the summer, of course, down there. And talked to the naturalist and the environmentalist and the meteorologist and folks like that there, some of those that were around there year-round. And there's not much question in all of our minds that some rather powerful changes are taking place. You can see the glaciers breaking up. You could see, you could just see the signs of the fact that and they were saying it's global warming, it's changed enormously. And you're talking about going to the Arctic, we already know that the Arctic ice and the Arctic glaciers are breaking up also. So
there's
a lot of change going on the Earth right now.
In 2006, the Northwest Passage opened up so that a non-icebreaker could actually get into it.
The first time, right?
Oh, yeah. And in 2007, it started to refreeze, and now it takes an icebreaker to get into it again. But there is still one ship that can make it through there and get to the other side of the Arctic Circle where we want to go. I was reflecting last night as I was driving back from another town back to this biodiesel plant that we're building up here, and I was looking at the stars. And I realized that this little blue ball is very unique in that we're the only planet in perhaps, I don't know, 25,000 light years in any direction
with liquid
water.
It's discovered now, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have liquid water. I mean, do you think possibly that this was an engineered environment?
Well, I don't think that. I mean, I don't think it was engineered, but necessarily. But it's certainly amazing that that life is here. But I have the feeling, I have a belief that life is throughout the universe, and we just have to find the rest of it. They find us, but I'm pretty sure we're not that unique.
Well, I don't think that we're unique, but I do think that water, liquid water, is unique. And water is certainly a unique molecule. It has
that is true. It's been
got
survival,
very, very amazing electromagnetic properties.
Yeah.
And you know, with the idea, well, with the realization that it exists in large quantities in liquid form here on this world, and naturally, that it would be quite an attraction for any intelligent race that happened to be passing through this quadrant of the galaxy.
Yeah. Well, it's. I guess we can conjecture as to, you know, how scarce or prevalent these various minerals and materials are, and how they came to be. But and we, that again, we're so primitive in that regard, we really don't know what's out there. And you're right about asking those questions, because there's so much that we just don't know.
Well, if this non-locality really is the next frontier, and
I think you bet your life it is, right?
I think it is. I have utmost respect, if it wasn't such a reflection of my own ego and perhaps envy, for those of you that had the opportunity to travel beyond the bounds of our planet. But I am ultimately convinced, and I think you are too, that we will not explore the stars riding in titanium cans. We will learn how to use this zero-point region for our next vehicle.
I'm hoping that that is the case, yes. I agree that the energy contained in the zero-point area, zero-point field, which they now call a new ether since Michelson Morley got rid of the old ether, erroneously, the new ether, that there's a lot more energy capability and a lot more stuff out there that we can learn to utilize that we just haven't learned to use yet.
Well, I'm curious to see if you see the same flaw that I do in the Michelson-Morley experiment. Maybe you can explain to our listeners what that was and why it was inconclusive.
Well, I'm not, since I haven't studied the details of exactly how they performed it, I don't think I can comment on it. But
before we get into it, the real error was saying
space was empty. Space was empty, therefore space was empty, because, regardless of what they measured.
Right. Well, I have a caller on the line. Let's honor that. Caller,
okay.
Your first name and where you're calling from?
Hi, Brooks. This is Joe Estella. I have a question for Dr. Mitchell. Doctor, I'm the president of Green Star Products. I've been on the program before. And our company, Green Star, is totally involved in climate change. And, of course, we are building biodiesel plants and have technology in that area. I was a good friend of Olaf Johnson, who was at my wedding in 1983 in Las Vegas, and I conducted many experiments with Olaf, and he told me that he was involved in the experiments that you had mentioned early in this program, in the Apollo 14 program. My question is, could you just explain what was Olaf's involvement in that program?
Well, yes, he was one of the four psychics. He was the only true professional psychic, or claimed to be a professional psychic, that was involved and produced results just like the others. We pooled all the results and sent them off. My only problem with Olaf is that we were pledged to secrecy till we got all this in, and he proceeded to talk to the press right after I got down from space and was still in quarantine, and before the results had really been opened up by J.B. Ryan and Carlos Osis.
Well, I think it's unfortunate, of course, giving out results before you had them. Olaf was under tremendous pressure from a lot of people from all over the world, mainly investors from Wall Street, who were trying to offer him a lot of money to predict, for example, to go into his state of whatever his trance was, to read tomorrow's papers, predict the stock market, predict football games, I mean, horse races, you name it. And as you know, he was a very sensitive man. So it's unfortunate that, you know. Well, thank you for answering my question. I really appreciate that.
You bet.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Thank you.
I think we might have another caller. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from? Nope. Okay, we don't have another caller. All right, so we're talking about, and maybe we can pontificate a little bit on it, that the Michelson-Morley experiment was an interferometer. It was a laser beams set up at right angles to test to see if the speed of light was altered by the Earth itself moving through the ether of space. And, in those days, they couldn't get long distances. They didn't know how to draw vacuum on a long tube, and they had to run you know, fairly short laser beams, and now they have the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, and they're not really measuring the speed of light anymore. They're looking for black holes with it.
Right.
But the experiment was flawed because it wasn't sensitive enough to really tell if there was a difference made by the gravity of Earth or the gravitational body of Earth moving through space. At least that's my take on it.
Yeah. All right. I can't speak to that, because I haven't studied the details of the experiment itself. But the fact, you know, that we have redshift when we look at the receding planets shows that there certainly is a shift in the apparent wavelength, just a so-called Doppler effect, when a source of light is moving away from you. And that's really what they were looking for, and they obviously didn't detect it. But I'm not quite sure whether that... but they did come to an erroneous conclusion that space had to be empty since they didn't measure any difference in their the speed of light on one side of the Earth or as opposed to the other, one orientation as opposed to the other.
Exactly. So now we know that space isn't empty, and you flew through it at, you know, somewhere around 25,000 miles an hour. So what do you feel? Do you feel that there's energy and information streaming through space?
Well, I think our quantum physics analysis and understanding at this point definitely convinces us that there's plenty of energy in space. And the fact that particles and antiparticles are popping in and out of existence all the time in free space, and this whole area we call the zero-point energy field is quite a phenomenon in itself, and perhaps even a usable source of energy if we just learn how to tap it. There's a lot of experimental work going on to try to tap that as a energy source.
Do you think we're going to get a chance?
Yep, I think we are.
We are talking about the stratification, let's call it the fractalization of the human race as the feedback mechanism goes into genetics, goes into consciousness, and we are stratifying into very, very warlike beings and then very, very peaceful beings. We don't even have the levels of adrenaline in our system that we used to because we don't need them. We don't have the need for fight or flight anymore.
Well, that's
now,
true. Yeah.
I was...
We really need to get past this fight thing for the very simple reason that we do have nuclear technology, and if we don't come to realize that violence only begets more violence, we in due course, somebody will start to resurrect and want to use nuclear technology. And when we do that, it's all over.
Well, that's true. I was reading a headline in the Washington paper, one of the local papers from Spokane, recently that one in 99 adults is in jail.
Yes, and that's right. It's awful.
Well, when you think about law enforcement in this country, we don't really have an army in our country. We have police. And police are budgeted in size to take care of approximately 2% of society. 98% of any society will just spontaneously obey the law. They won't cause trouble. They'll work with each other. They understand laws and they work within them.
Yep.
But 2% have no respect for that law or human life, for that matter, and they must be policed. And it is, whether you want to believe it or not, the same people who commit crime over and over and over again. It's not new people every day.
Yeah, that's true, and it is a major problem to me of evolution. How do we evolve out of that? I think we can, but it's a major problem of how do we get past that aspect of our human nether, lower selves, that is tied up in that sort of activity when we really need to get past that if we're going to really be a successful species and become a civilization. We're not really a civilization doing what we're doing. That's true.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I'm glad that I'm not faced with the legislative decisions that our lawmakers are and how to correct that. But ultimately, it must be solved with incarceration and rehabilitation rather
yep.
than, you know, genocide or elimination. But one way or another, if we find a way to find the good in human beings and bring it out, then we'll make that happen. Now, one of the most remarkable statistics that I saw was actually collected by Oliver North, of all people.
Okay.
And he said that 95% of the men on death row grew up without a father.
That could very well be true. That could very well be true. And I don't know that statistic personally, but it is true that the breakdown of the family and the lack of attention to properly raising the young, I'm sure, is a major part of the problem you're talking about.
Well, it probably is, and I'm not going to say that any one structure is better than any other structure.
Nope.
Whether
we don't know the answer to that.
Whether it's one wife or four wives or husbands or, you know, two mothers, I don't know. I don't know which one would be better. But
well, I think it's more the attention to the task than whether the children have to have different parents or more than one parent or a broken family. But if there's attention to the task of raising children and recognizing that whether you stay with the same mate or not, you have a responsibility to raise the children. That's pretty important.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I guess where I was trying to go with it is it goes beyond that. That if we're introduced to this ultimate connectedness between us all and between us and our planet and maybe between us and all the matter and all the energy in the universe, and we realize that we are not separate from God at all.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe that makes the difference.
That is exactly why I believe that this modern physics that we're talking about and these epiphany experiences of connectedness, of oneness, and the ancient mystics were saying that. And we have come along now with a quantum physical explanation that shows from science how that is true. And that's to me, is very vital information.
Well, I guess if we're going to solve this, we've got to figure out as a race how to get past the tyrants and the greats and those that feel they have to conquer everything rather than, you know, enlighten that. How do we do that as a race? I mean, now you've discovered some great information in this book that if it were widely spread enough, might end war forever.
Well, that's what we would like to think, and I would hope that's true, but there's no question but what it's a major, really, truly a major problem that we humans have got to solve, and quickly, because our technology, our violence is getting, our population is getting enormous and out of hand, as it were. I wish we had the answers to all of that, and we sure don't. But there sure are big problems we've got to tackle.
Oh, yeah. We've mentioned a couple times tonight that we have moved from covered wagon to spacecraft in less than 100 years. But where did the dollars come from to make that happen?
Well, we're just going to have to find them, that's all.
Well, you mentioned in your career that you're former Navy, that you came up through the armed services, and that it was primarily, at least what drives satellite technology today, is mostly defense. It's mostly military.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. And we definitely, but I don't think we need to do that. I think we can learn. There have been several small nations now tried to do it with peace, more peaceful means. Costa Rica, for one, and a few others that have tried to do it without armies. And I think those are noble experiments. And we've got to do a lot more of that in order to start turning the tide here and keeping ourselves from being a warlike planet. I won't call that a civilization.
Right. I'm with you there. So the money is normally drawn from some budget that's taken through taxes, and it's appropriated one way or another, ultimately to keep elected officials elected or reelected, if that's the case.
Yeah.
So congressmen and senators are all about appropriating that money, and Kennedy was no different. I mean, he saw the popularity of the space program, and it was popular, and we did get to the moon when he said we would. But shortly after Apollo 14, hey, we lost interest in it, did we not?
Yeah, we did, and Congress cut off our funds, and people said been there, done that, and didn't really have the vision to understand that we could keep going and should keep going. But that's the way it is. But we just have to keep working at it day by day, person by person. It's converting people one at a time, I guess.
Well, maybe that's the way it has to be done. It seems a shame that it started out as a military venture, turned into a venture of entertainment, and once we had seen that movie, we decided to move on to other things. Now, there are some 68 active NASA programs right now, and that's to their credit. They're all over the solar system and now stretching out into the galaxy, still returning data to us. But I agree with our guest that our real next jump from the covered wagon is this non-local communication, non-local probing, non-local even travel to other points in our galaxy and our universe. Since this is your area of study, what's going on out there? Is there any promise coming down the road, any experiments being done that are yielding some hope?
Well, I think there's a lot. There's some stuff in the black area, too, that I'm hoping and think will be opened up here before very long. It definitely needs to be. And there is, I think, technologies almost available to us that can help us get to that outside of our solar system experience and certainly get deeper into our solar system, if not beyond it, within the next century.
Well, what about it? Do you think it will be driven by the same forces that Joe LaStella was talking about earlier, that Wall Street will say, can you just give us a glimpse of 7 days in the future so we can bet our money and make ourselves even richer? Or
I think we've got to move more toward the notion of service to the greater good rather than service to making me richer or you richer or anybody else richer. That we're only going to survive if we really start to think about service to the greater good. Now, that sounds like a big stretch, but I think it's an important one. And devoting ourselves to that is probably the most satisfying thing an individual can do. And there have been many have shown that, but it's a tough one to sell. It's a tough, hard sell. But I think it's going to be necessary for our survival.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I agree so much that, maybe I participate in the engineering of the new paradigm, being up here in eastern Washington State, designing and building a biodiesel plant to turn non-food products and oils into fuel so that we can quit burning petroleum as a way of getting around our planet, which
we're
is about as ancient as...
We're going to have to do that fairly quickly because it's about done.
Yep. Well,
I was talking about this almost 30 years ago. One of my first major speeches was in Lausanne, Switzerland, to a Rotary International Convention. And I was talking about, we didn't call it peak oil at that time, but that was
right.
The idea that I was talking about, and that was in 1973.
A lot of people don't know that the United States only sits on 2% of the world's oil reserves.
Yep.
That's really not a sustainable lifestyle unless you're going to find another source of fuel, and that's what we're all about.
That's right, and there's a lot of potential, and one of my research projects and one of my research foundations is devoted precisely to looking for these alternative approaches and utilizing this frontier sciences for exactly these issues that we're talking about here.
Well, that's good, and if we're doing it, then there are other people doing it.
There are people doing it. There are people coming to the fore now and recognizing that we do have a sustainability issue before us, and we're all going to have to participate and get involved, it's going to be too late. There's no assurance that we have to make it.
And yep, that's
whether
right.
we make it or not is up to us.
We're working like there's no tomorrow up here, and in
yep.
5 weeks or so, we're going to turn the spigot on. It'll be good.
Well, good for you. That's we're all singing out of the same hymnal right then.
Yes, we are. We don't always bring guests on that sing out of the same hymnal, so it's kind of nice to have one.
I'm sure.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. Well, it has been absolute pleasure to have you on the program, and I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed your book. I've got 4 different colors of Post-it notes sticking out the side of it.
Oh, great.
I've really enjoyed it. Now, you say you're working on another book. When is that one going to come out?
Well, that's going to be a while yet. I'm working first. I'm going to get a monograph out here this year on this whole quantum holographic approach that is basically a non-local approach that you're talking about to information transfer and to understanding how the tree falls in the forest, as it were.
Yeah,
and
we call
we're
that
working
the,
on that, and we'll have that done, and we'll probably do another book shortly thereafter.
Oh, that's fantastic. Where are you working on that?
Right here in Florida. Fortunately,
due to
internet and colleagues in Europe and in the United States, our communications are quite good these years, and I can sit at my desk and do an awful lot, although I spend quite a bit of time on the road also.
Well, if you want to drop me into your communications loop, I would be more than happy to participate.
Okay.
I'm too right and still active in my research and have discovered a few things. We affectionately call it the beryllium ion modem. I was talking with Jim Bell, who runs the Mars rover program on Mars, and he was complaining about how long it takes to get in from, you know, commands from here to Mars into the rovers, make a turn, drive forward 20 yards, and then it comes back and gives the results. He said it takes hours and hours and hours to get commands back and forth. That's just what you need.
Right.
I
thought it was rough taking 2 seconds or more. You could a noticeable delay between the moon and the Earth, you see, in radio communication.
Well, what's amazing about your experiment is here you were making non-local communication, statistically significant non-local communication, and you were 20,000 miles away, which is impossible on this planet. You were 250,000 miles away.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Beyond the Van Allen radiation belts, and you were still communicating.
Yep. Yep, and that was one of the significant things, of course, is that it showed that the non-local communication at least reaches out 240,000 miles.
Well, that's amazing. I mean,
the theory says infinity, but we haven't tested infinity, but we haven't tested 240,000 miles. Yep.
Oh, there he is. Okay, I hear you. I know your phone's running out of battery, so I'm going to let you go for tonight. And I really appreciate you being on the program, X Squared Radio. This is Dr. Edgar Mitchell, our guest. So I will let you get
it. It's been great being with you. And
it's late on the East Coast.
Okay, yes, you're right. Thank you, Brooks.
Thank you so much. We'll be back in touch.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, that's it, Space Explorers and Earth Explorers. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, author of The Way of the Explorer. And we want to encourage you to go ahead and pick up a copy of that book. We are still live on the air, so we have about 10 minutes. If you would like to call in, we can go ahead and take whatever questions that you have. We'll take all those calls here in the last 10 minutes of the program. If not, then I will just continue with a little bit more information that I have about one thing. As I said earlier in the program, in about 5 weeks, we're going to be turning this spigot on here at this facility and converting canola oil, which is, as you know, not a food, into diesel fuel directly. And it's the first process of its kind. Now, it's been done since the late 1800s, and there are lots and lots of little biodiesel plants all over the country experimenting. And there are a lot of big biodiesel plants that are closed because they're still using that 1850s technology. This is 21st century technology, and it does function. If you want to learn more about that technology, you can do so by clicking on the link at X Squared Radio, or you can go directly there. The website is greenstarusa.com. Just go there, learn a little bit about the industry, learn a little bit about the leaders in the industry and what's going on. We are happy to come to you live via the BBS Radio Network and the Steel Eye Media Network, thanks to our friend Kevin Smith. And next week, we have a surprise guest for you. We're still working on firming it up, but I know that you'll be excited about who's coming on. And on the 16th of March, we have Miriam Delicato. As you know, she has communicated with the tall, blonde ETs, and she has received some messages for us. As you know, her book, Blue Angel, is rocketed up the charts, and she's been all over the country talking about this book. An amazing, bright, shining woman with a great message, and we want you to be sure to check into that. And then on the 23rd, Ken Klein. So keep coming back to x2-radio.com. Check out our guests link, and you'll see who has been on the program. Over 150 guests over the last 3 years. Almost 500 hours of interviews there that you can read or listen to, and I'm sure you'll be as entertained as you were tonight. My thanks to you for being part of the program all around the world, and whether you're listening live or whether you are working on your favorite project while sitting at your computer, we appreciate you being here, and more than you know. So we will bid you farewell for tonight, and we will be back with you next week at the same time, and peace. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.